Okay, and welcome to the second lecture today. And we will have a gift of double lecture tomorrow as well. So happy times. So last time we discussed this BBN, Big Bang synthesis, and that happened about 3 minutes after the Big Bang. So small t was about 3 minutes. And it also happened, you know, around 1 MeV when the temperatures were approximately 1 MeV. And that was deeply in the radiation era. So actually, at the time, everything was relativistic. And so we had basically the dominant component of the universe was radiation. So now we are going to move to much later times when actually this is no longer true. It's already matter-dominated era. So most things are already non-relativistic. And temperatures are much lower. So BBN was radiation era, and that was about the temperature, which was like 1 MeV. So now CMB is much later, so that's in matter dominated era. And the temperatures you'll talk about now is around 1 electron volt or something like that. So much, 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 much later, much, much cooler thing. So at the time, still the universe was basically filled with plasma. So we had plasma. And the plasma consisted of electrons and protons. And so we had a proton here. We had an electron here. We know that this is after the Big Bang nuclear synthesis. So we have also helium. And then we have lithium and other things. But all these are ionized. So they haven't captured the electrons. And so there's another electron here. And of course, in between everywhere, there is the radiation. So lots of photons everywhere, lots of neutrinos. But neutrinos are already decoupled, so they don't really interact with anything else. And so this was the soup of, you know, photons and electrons and baryons, ionized baryons at this time. So now, whenever you have plasma, you have oscillations, characteristic oscillations for plasma. And it's simply caused by the fact that, you know, things are attracted to each other gravitationally. So they try to, you know, squeeze together. For example, the protons try to, you know, go as well close. And but then there's, of course, also the pressure which balances this thing. And so whenever you start attracting something and then there is a repulsion, you have these characteristic oscillations of the plasma. And precisely at the time when the plasma sort of released the photons, these oscillations we will see in the cosmic microwave background. Okay, so that's the origin of these things. So how the CMB was really released, and so there are three important events. Only the last one will really, you know, free the photons, but let me just mention three of them. So the first one would be a combination of light elements, like a combination, and of course we know that it's mostly hydrogen and helium, so it's the helium which we combine, and the reason for that is actually the ionization potential for helium is bigger than that of hydrogen. So really this helium plus plus eventually captures the electrons and becomes neutral. Okay, so this is what I mean by recombination of helium. And this happened about the temperature, which is 5,000 kelvins. Okay, but even after that happened, actually, so the hydrogen is still ionized, and the photons still, you know, bump into electrons and into other things. So you still cannot see anything. You still have the soup. Only the helium is now neutral. but they still soup of all these things, and you cannot really see through these things. Okay, so universe is still opaque. And so that's not where the CMB comes from. However, you know, the plasma changed a little bit. So now you have this neutral hydrogen, and that has an effect on these characteristic oscillations. In other words, the speed of sound in this plasma actually changed after the helium became neutral. And so that actually has influence on what these fluctuations are as you see them when the CMB was released. So the fluctuations here are different from the fluctuations after helium was neutralized. Okay. So anyway, so we have the first step is the recombination of helium. The second step is where actually the hydrogen becomes neutral. So recombination. Hydrogen that became later. So you have proton captures electron, forms a hydrogen. And stuff like that. I will not discuss this here because you will discuss it in your homework too. So the problem when discussing this process, of course, is a non-equilibrium thing. Again, you should be solving Boltzmann equation. Now, what you'll do in your homework is that you will do basically equilibrium approximation, the corresponding equation. The equilibrium thermodynamic equation is called Saha equation. And so you will discuss Saha equation. But of course, that gives the wrong result, but not so wrong. So if you shuffle the numbers and whatever, then you can get whatever you want. So you get the right result even with the Saha equation in your homework. Let me just introduce this number, which is the number of remaining free electrons divided by number of baryons. And this is called ionization fraction. Ionization fraction. And so treating this in this as an equilibrium thermodynamics process, you have this. So we can use this Saha approximation. As you will do in your homework too. But basically you say, well, all the hydrogen basically is already neutral once this ionization fraction, the number of free electrons divided by number of baryons, is sufficiently small. And so you will take it for your homework, like Xe is 0.1. So I have 10 times less free electrons than originally. And so this happens at T recombination, which is 3600 Kelvin. Or at a redshift, which is something like 1300.
This 0.1 is the definition of recombination?
Like yeah, so we will use this approximation, we will use the equilibrium description. So for the actual calculation, we will define that ionization fraction, and we will define, well, actually, I will have the enthalpy combination, meaning I have all neutral hydrogen when this is satisfied. Okay. So after this, we have basically neutral hydrogen. So now you might think, well, if I have neutral hydrogen, then actually the photons are happy and they can roam free. But it's not still true. And the reason for that is that you still have some leftover electrons. So there's still quite a few electrons and lots of photons. But whenever you have electrons, the photons like to bump into them. And so there's various scatterings. And so the one which is interesting for us is the Thomson scattering. So So the photons are still coupled to this plasma thing, basically. So until the photon decoupling, and so remaining electrons still bump like crazy to our photons, and this is through Thomson's scattering. Thomson scattering. Okay, this is just the classical process how photons are absorbed by electrons and then radiated away again. Okay, so we have electron bumps into gamma and produces electron and gamma. And so this reaction still is going on, even though the number of free electrons is actually, you know, relatively small. So now you can say that actually this Thomson scattering ceases to work when you really don't have any electrons. And so for not really having any electrons, let me divide this number again by 10. Okay, so then at about xe 0.01, now this stops. This stops. And that happens at about t decoupling, which is like 3,300 Kelvin, or z 1100. Okay, and so you have all this, still all this soup, and you have some electrons here, and then the photons move like crazy in between them and bump into them all the time. But at about this temperature, 3,300 Kelvin, actually there is not enough electrons. And so the photons actually are now free to roam out of that soup. Okay? So this, at the time when this happened, the surface is called the surface of last scattering. Surface of last scattering. So that's basically when it happened. And then after that, photons roam free. And the truth is that they basically typically never scatter again. So, you know, whatever the photons were produced at the surface of the last scattering, then actually the photons travel through the universe, and now we observe them as CMB. So that happened at this temperature, 3,300 Kelvin, but as the photons travel through the expanding universe, of course they are redshifted, and because they are redshifted, their temperature decreases, and so now their temperature, because it's like 1 over 1,000, so their temperature actually is 1,000 times more, so about 3 Kelvin now. Okay, so from 3, most never scatter again. And so they just get redshifted due to the expansion of the universe, and the temperature is about 3 Kelvin. No. And so we observe these photons out of this, you know, thing as the CMB radiation. Yes?
How does the ionization fraction change?
How does it change? Yeah. The XE? Well,
sorry.
So typically the things are exponentially decaying if you have massive things. So in this point, the electrons actually become massive, right? So they typically exponentially decay. So this thing, of course, depends on the temperature, right? So it's the e to minus m over t, m minus mu over t, or whatever. All right. Are there any other questions? So that's what's happening through this, you know, particle point of view. So now let me discuss some basic properties of the CMB radiation. I'll return to CMB radiation next week, and we will discuss more properties, more mass next week. But this week I'll be just very, very vague and tell you about the basic properties. So first of all, CMB spectrum, CMB, okay. And you know, the fact that I'm assigning to CMB a temperature T just tells you that it behaves like black body. So it's actually the distribution of energies there is described by one single number, the temperature, and that happens for the black body. So by the way, CMB discovered in 1964. I think, by Penzias and Wilson. The radio telescope. Okay. And they got the Nobel Prize for this 1978. Nobel Prize 1978. So the history of discovery and prediction of CMB is actually very, very interesting, because it's not the first observation of CMB. CMB was actually first observed in 1941, but it was not connected with what, you know, with the cosmology or with what could be coming from the universe. So 1941 first measured, 1948 first predicted theoretically by Gamov. So he actually he had this picture in mind, starting this hot Big Bang, and then he calculated what this temperature of the radiation actually could be now. And so I think he was off by a factor of 10 or something like that. So it was like order of 30 kelvins or something. 30 kelvins probably predicted. But anyway, so Gamow was the first one to theoretically predict, and then both the measurement and the prediction disappeared. And then comes this miraculous year of 64, where basically two independent groups had to do something with the CMB. So first there was this Princeton group led by Dickey, who actually they founded the theoretical predictions. They didn't know about Gamow's work, so actually they made the prediction themselves. And then they suggested, yeah, we should be looking for the CMB radiation now, and we should be trying to measure it. But at the same time, it was the other group at Bell's or whatever, where they actually, these two gentlemen, they discovered it by mere luck. They just built a new antenna, new radio telescope, and they heard some strange noise, and they couldn't get rid of that noise. And they concluded that the noise is not coming from Earth, it's not coming from our solar system, it's not coming from our galaxy. Okay, so they could do that. So they started communicating. I don't know how did they actually get to know that the other Princeton group is working on that. But anyway, they phoned each other and whatever. And then they showed them the preprint about the theory, and they showed them the experimental measurement. But in the end, it's only these two gentlemen, the actually experimentalists, or who actually observed that, who got the Nobel Prize. It wasn't Dickey, it wasn't Gamow, it wasn't the people. In 1941, it was just these two guys. Okay, so it's quite interesting to read about it. I think, so poor theoreticians. So if you are a theoretician, then you are screwed, okay? So you can read about this in Wikipedia, there's a very nice article about that. Okay, so what we really observe is perfect black body. Okay. So I'll draw it in terms of the intensity dependent on the frequency. And this is just the standard plot. So I have frequency 2 and 18 and some stupid units, 10 to the 10 hertz, 3 times 10 to the 10 hertz. And then this is your perfect blackbody. And this is what Penzias and Wilson measured. So they measured these few points on the graph, but it fit, you know, the blackbody nicely. And then later people expanded this measurement, and they couldn't get really into these frequencies here because actually the radiation is shielded by atmosphere. So they couldn't really measure this part of the graph, but it was measured later by COBE satellite. Okay, and so then it fits very nicely the whole curve. So if I just write the intensity, the formula is whatever, it's energy per time, per area, per solid angle coming from you. So 2h nu cube over c square 1 e h nu kt minus 1, where I restored all the units. So this is the curve, and really it was experimentally observed. So now what is funny is that the temperature is, this thing, the frequencies are perfect black body if you are looking at, you know, one spot in the sky. But if you look at another spot on the sky, then you see, again, perfect black body, but with slightly different temperature. Okay. So in each direction, slightly different temperature. And the fluctuations of the temperature are however small. So if you studied cosmology 25 years ago or whatever, then you would say, yeah, it's just one temperature T. But now it's measured more accurately. So actually, the average temperature is 2.7 Kelvin. And the fluctuations, delta T, is T minus T0 divided by T0 are of the order of 10 to minus 5. OK, so if looking at different angles on the sky, I see slightly different temperatures, but in each direction is a perfect black body. And so what it means is actually that this plasma was really in equilibrium just before the photons were released. And so that's why you establish perfect, you know, black body radiation inside this, like a cavity or whatever. And then after the surface of last scattering, these photons just, you know, travel free, but they still carry the information about the equilibrium inside the plasma. And that's why you have a perfect black body. Questions? OK, so what people do is that they plot these fluctuations on a beach ball, and then they project it to an atlas as you know it. So of course, if I look around, I see a sphere. And then I project it to an atlas. So multiple expansion and you do the expansion on the sphere. So expand delta T on S2, and then you plot it like an atlas So I'll have delta t always depends on theta and phi. And then you will have teeny tiny fluctuations here. So tiny fluctuations. Of course, because 10 to minus 5 is really, really small, you subtract this 2.7 as we did over there. Okay. So this is what we have. And then because you are doing basically like a Fourier series, Fourier expansion on a sphere, instead of the basis e exponential ikx, you use the basis of spherical harmonics. Okay, so that's the right thing to do on the sphere. And so you write delta t theta and phi is sum over L and M, L to L, and then you measure the coefficients of expansion, ALM, and this is your basis, which is the spherical harmonic. And this is the expansion coefficients. So you observe this, and you find the expansion coefficients from here. Okay. So it's obvious that if you fix L, then you have 2L plus 1 of these ALMs. 2L plus 1 ALMs describing that. Because it's like if you talk about the spin in the z direction and total angular momentum and whatever. Okay, so that's the same thing. So now what might be interesting that there's this very approximate formula which relates the value of L to actually the size of the thing which you observe on the sky. So angular scale. On the sky, and so you can relay this theta approximately to pi over L. So bigger L is, smaller, well, finer things you see on the sky, right? So if I take L equal to 1, I just say, well, there's something overall over the whole sky. If I take L to be really, really large, then I'm talking about what's happening here, what's happening here, what's happening here, what's happening here. So finer resolution you get for large L. Okay. So finally, what people really actually observe and what they really plot is not these ALMs, but they plot something which is rotationally invariant. So now if you rotate the sky around, that's invariant with respect to this rotation. And so that's called power spectrum. Our spectrum denoted by CL. And if you want, the definition of this is that you get CL for given L by doing 1 over 2L plus 1, and then you sum over M minus L to L, and then you take the magnitudes of ALM square. Okay? So this is the power spectrum. And it is rotationally invariant. Rotationally invariant. So it's a good quantity to measure. And so what the meaning of this guy really is that if I fix L and look at that ALM, So m can run from minus l to plus l. So you can think about these ALMs for fixed l as a vector which has 2l plus 1 dimensional vector ALM. And then this thing here is just the magnitude of that vector. And so I measure that, weight that by this 2l plus, by the total thing. Okay, so this is just how big the vector is in ALM space. Okay. Very good. So this is what people really, you know, plot and measure and whatever. And so let me just draw it here for the first time. This CL, not really, typically multiplied by some L, but doesn't matter. So L here, and then I have L 250, 500, and other things, 1000. And then you have these nice peaks here. And so this is what people really measure. Power spectrum. And if you want, this picture contains all of cosmology. Okay, so based on cosmological model, as we will discuss it next week, you will see that there are six parameters. Only six parameters, which basically describe our universe. So all you need is six numbers. Of course, there are, you have also additional numbers which take natural values, typically zero. But six non-trivial, non-zero parameters, and actually you can fit all the data about the universe. In particular, you can fit this power spectrum here. Seem to be enough to describe all this. If you see these plots, you will see some kind of error bars here as well. And so these error bars are typically quite big for small l. And then they're getting much, much smaller later on and basically disappear for large l. So these error bars are called cosmic variants. And for its precise meaning, you will have to wait till next week. But basically, it's related to the fact that you are doing statistics on a system where you have only one measurement. Okay, so you have the universe occurred only once, so you have only one measurement, but you still want to do some statistics on this one measurement, and that actually results in this uncertainty for small l, okay? And so this uncertainty diminishes as l goes bigger, but for small l, this is quite big. So now, interestingly, it's precisely that small l where some interesting predictions are. So for example, Ashtekar delivered a talk 2 years ago on GR conference where he actually claims that loop quantum cosmology predicts the modification of the spectrum, but unfortunately in this region. Okay, so yeah, so maybe there are some quantum gravity effects telling you about this, but unfortunately it's all within this cosmic variance thing. So we cannot really decide, well, you judge on yourself what is this. Okay, are there any questions to this? Could I get the screen, please?
Question about the angular scale. What happens when L is zero? What does it mean?
Okay. So, you know, so what I'm doing here is like a multiple expansion. Mm-hmm. So I'm expanding this delta t, but in some sense, L equal to one. So you should be starting at L equal to two or something like that. So you are subtracting, so there's this average temperature everywhere the same, which would be like the first multiple expansion. And then you are subtracting also some velocity, which is like the next one or something like that. So actually, I'm not starting at L equal to zero. I was lying to you. I'm starting later, the expansion. Thank you so much. So let's see if this works. I just wanted to show you a few pictures because it would be real shame not to show you the actual data. And let's see if it's... maybe? Yeah! But why do you see both of them? It's interesting. Okay. Okay, I'll just show you this way. Okay, so first of all, no experimental data, just your homework. So this is precisely what happens, like when the recombination happens, where the decoupling of things happen. And so you will study in your homework this Sahow approximation, and then you will use that there's some freeze out of these things here. So Saha is again the equilibrium description as you would know it. This is the true Boltzmann description, but if you shuffle things around, you know, nicely, then the Saha approximation gives you the right freeze out and gives you the right thing. So this is how you will calculate, you know, the temperatures when the decoupling happened and when the recombination happened and stuff like that. So this is your homework, just a short. So now more interesting thing is of course this antenna. So this is precisely what got them the Nobel Prize, despite the fact that they were not looking for it. And so because, you know, you see this dish, which is really, you know, pointing. So you can shield everything which is not going inside, right? And so that's why you can actually say it's not coming from Earth, it's not coming from our galaxy or whatever. You can really point the antenna to some direction, and you can say, yeah, is it actually coming from here or is it coming from somewhere else? So this is, yeah, Benzias and Wilson's Nobel Prize thing. And then this thing here is precise blackbody power spectrum. And so this is as measured by the satellite. And this is what they did. So they could measure. So this looks differently, but these are logarithmic units. So this is what they measured in the power spectrum. And this, so now you have the atmospheric shield, so you cannot really, you know, it's shielded by the atmosphere. But then this is what the satellite measured, so you have perfect blackbody spectrum here. So now let's go to this CMB map, the fluctuation map, and you see how this actually evolved in resolution. So first measurement was by the satellite in 92. Satellite, and you have the resolution as such, and then you have the W map in 2003, and finally the latest thing is the Planck thing, and so you can go to really, very large L, now to really, very small resolution, and so you have many more peaks, and you have the tail here and stuff like that. So in the tail, the peaks are not so big or whatever, so there's a tail, but it's small fluctuations. Okay, so this is how the CMB looks like now, and I don't know whether here or somewhere else, but definitely I think in Santa Barbara you can buy a beach ball where this is actually plotted. Okay. So this is the current resolution of these fluctuations. So now this is the power spectrum, and so you see the cosmic variance here, which is the red things. So you see that the cosmic variance is really getting tiny for large L. And so the most dominant is this first peak, and then the fraction of the first peak, the second peak, actually tells you about baryons and stuff like that. It tells you about the fluctuations of plasma at the time CMB was released. And so these are the measurement of things. And so the way how to remember this is the following graph. Certainly you attended some seminar, and so you start with the speaker's variance, you know, sometimes it's good or bad, and you start not very high expectations, but then it may happen that you actually, at some point, you have an idea, well, I understood what the speaker is talking about, and so it's great, and I understand everything, but then you realize maybe not so, actually, confusion drop, and then you say, maybe actually, okay, I didn't understand what's going on, but maybe there's still something for me seminar, so you have you have some interesting point, and but then there are, you know, technical details, and so you go low again, And so now you look at the watch and say, well, maybe it's almost over, but it's never over, right? There's these endless questions. And so that's the tale, and it never finishes, okay? So this is how you should remember and replot this very, very important graph of the power spectrum, which basically tells you everything about the current understanding of cosmology. Okay, so thank you so much. So can I get it up again? Thanks. Are there any questions?
Can we get that slide somewhere?
I'll send you the slide.
I still don't know how you plot the sphere, two sphere on that. What's the coordinate on the 2D?
Oh, so this is like you have spherical Earth or whatever, and you make a map of that Earth, and then you make a projection into 2D atlas.
I'm asking, what's the projection?
What's the projection? It's the same as for 2D atlas. So there's some deformation, of course. You know that. It depends who is plotting the Earth, right? So sometimes Russia is bigger, sometimes Canada is bigger, whatever, depending on where you start and how you make the projection. Yeah. Okay. So this is the first look at CMB, as I said. We will return back to CMB next week, and we will talk about its polarization, and we will talk about this cosmic variance and stuff like that. But you know, just to give you the first idea of what's going on. Questions? So if there are no questions, let me start part E, which will be really first look at dark matter. But there won't ever be a second look. Dark matter. And you know, one of the reasons is that you will have, I hope, a course, Explorations on Particle Physics. And that course will be all about dark matter. So you know what the possible candidates are, how does it fit to the standard model, or how you go beyond standard model, and stuff like that. So we'll have all bloody details there. So let me just give you basically the observational facts, why we think there might be dark matter. And then I'll leave that. Okay, so why do cosmologists think there might be dark matter? There is dark matter. And actually, the first evidence goes back very, you know, very, very early. And it goes back to 1930s. So goes back to 1930s by Fritz Zwicky. And so what he did is he studied the cluster of galaxies. So studied cluster of galaxies. And so what these things are is approximately lots of galaxies. So you have galaxies here. And so they are all gravitationally held together. The average distance in between them, let's say, is something which you can observe, is distance r. And so these galaxies are moving inside this cluster of galaxies, and they have velocities v. Okay, so cluster of galaxies is a statistically steady spherical self-gravitating system of n galaxies or n objects of average mass m. And so that's the mass of the galaxy, average galaxy in this cluster. So this is like spherically symmetric. And average orbital velocity p. Okay, so that's what cluster of galaxies is. So now what you can do is that you can employ Newtonian theory to say something about these things. Of course, the gravity is quite weak here, so Newtonian approximation is fine. Moreover, because it's spherically symmetric, Newton is basically Einstein, apart from the very, very close nearby region, close to black hole. So Newtonian theory is fine. So you can calculate what is the kinetic energy of these galaxies inside the cluster. And it's just 1/2, and you have n of them, and then mv square. So that's the kinetic energy. Then you can calculate what the potential energy is. So u is minus, and then these are the number of possibilities you have, 2-point interactions, and then g m square over r. Is that correct? That's probably the I have m square. Let's hope I do. Okay, so now what you do is, so this is simple. You have kinetic energy, you have potential energy. Now you open now a list sheet that has everything in it. And you find page about Virial's theorem. And so Virial's theorem, it tells you that or statistical system, or whatever, on average, the following equality has to be true. And the average of kinetic energy has to be equal to minus 1/2 of the potential energy. Okay, so read Landau and Lifshitz if you want to. He has some beautiful scaling argument why this must be so. Okay. So now, this must be true. Now look at the dynamical mass. So the total dynamical mass is n times the average mass. And then you want to write it in terms of the things that you know. So what you can measure is the distance between the galaxies, the average distance r, and what you measure is this velocity v. Okay, so basically you solve for m in terms of v and r. Okay, so let's do it. So we have that e is 1/2 n mv square, and this is minus 1/2, and then this thing here. So it's n times n minus 1 over 2. But of course, minus 1 is approximately n. So it's n squared over 2. And then that's a plus sign here, because there's a minus here and minus here. And then gm squared over r. So now n cancels one of them, n cancels, m cancels. Is that m? And so you have small m. And then 1/2 cancels. So small m is something like 2r over v square. 2r v square divided by n and g. Okay, so that's what you get from the Virial theorem. And then the total mass is when you plug this m here. So this n cancels that n, and you have 2r v square divided by g. So now these are the things you measure. And what you find is, when you measure this, what you find is 10 times the mass which you actually see in stars. Okay, so M luminous is really, you know, how much mass there is in the shining matter, so in stars and stuff like that. But if you look at the total mass contained in this cluster, you actually conclude that there is 10 times more than there is in stars. Okay, so actually it tells you there is some extra matter which is not shining. Questions? So this was the first argument that there might be dark matter. People didn't take it seriously then until basically the end of 60s. And there was another argument that there must be dark matter even, you know, within the galaxy. So by the way, this guy also predicted that you can use gravitational lensing to detect dark matter. So basically using gravitational lensing as we know it. So if there is a dark matter in front of the star, then you would see brightening of the star or whatever. I don't think it has been measured yet, but he already in the 30s, he proposed that that may be the way for detecting this dark matter. So good guy. So now what really convinced people about dark matter is observation by Vera Rubin. And so what she did is that she studied galaxy rotation curves. Okay, so this is the galaxy. Like a Japanese weapon, but anyway. So, you know, lots of stars are in the arms and then, you know, here at the center. But you have also some extra struggling stars at the end here. Okay, so these are few struggling stars at the end of your arm of your galaxy. So you are very, very far away from the center. And of course, all this thing sort of orbits around the center and whatever. Okay. And so now you may be looking, what is the prediction for these stars? You know, how this velocity should look like based on how far they are from the center of the galaxy. So again, you will model this by Newtonian theory. And you will model this by spherical symmetry. It almost looks spherical symmetric, right? So by Kepler's law, so your gravitational force is g m of r over r squared. So how much mass at given radius r is inside that radius r. So that's my thing. And then this must be equal to the centrifugal force as long as I have, you know, not motion inside or outside of whatever. It's just orbital motion, v squared over r. So now what it means is that outside of matter, so if there is no more stars, no matter, then this guy becomes constant. So all the matter is already contained. Right, so if I move away, there is no extra matter which I see. So then M is just constant. M of R is just constant. And then you conclude that V is proportional to 1 over square root of R. Okay, so this is how V must behave. So now what she did, she measured these velocities of these struggling stars away from the center. And she plotted that. So you can plot V and then you can plot R, and then there is some radius up to which you see, you know, stars, and so R of visible light. So basically, for R's bigger than that, you don't see any stars. So everything inside the galaxy, which you can see, is below this this radius here. So now, in that case, the prediction, Newtonian prediction, should go like something like this. So here, M of R is getting bigger and bigger. That's why there's this increase. But once you are outside of visible star, so there's no more matter, and you have to have this 1 over square root of R decay, right? So this is the theoretical prediction according to Kepler or Newton's law. But the observation actually looks very, very much different. This is what is observed. And so what this tells you is actually even outside, you know, the radius where the last star is, there's still lots of matter hiding. And as you increase the radius, there's still lots of matter. But the matter is not shining matter. You cannot see that matter. Okay, so this is what is observed. And so there must be extra matter. And so this argument really convinced people that they should take dark matter seriously.
Isn't that usually posited as a straight line?
Yeah, it's almost straight line. Actually, it sort of increases for some time, and then it's almost like horizontal line. Yeah. Well, anyway, this is my plot of exact graphs or whatever. Okay, so this was great. So now there is dark matter. And so the first possible explanation you might think about is that the dark matter is just, you know, normal baryons, which are simply not hot enough so that they are not shining. So they are maybe the baryons which are not in stars, which are shining, but maybe they are baryons which are hidden in planets or something which is not shining, which is not hot enough so that we can see it. Okay? So now there are couple of arguments showing that this is actually not true, and that dark matter is not baryons. I will present you two arguments based on the measurement of this eta, your favorite eta, which played so much role in the Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So the first argument, maybe today, second argument, maybe tomorrow. So what you can show is that dark matter is not baryons. And so, for example, hiding in planets or something which is not hot enough. And so the reason for this, so one reason is this Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So again, you know, the ratio of how much you produce helium, how much you produce lithium, and stuff like that, although lithium is off, but other elements actually are fine, depends on this eta. Okay. So now you can show that after the Big Bang nucleosynthesis, so from 3 minutes, from the age of the universe at 3 minutes till now, this number is actually conserved. Okay, so what it means is that this 10 to minus 9 must still be true now. So this is number of baryons now divided by number of photons now. Okay, so now, of course, you know the number of photons now. That's something which you can easily measure from CMB. Okay, so you know that 10 to minus 9 is number of photons now, and so you can conclude what the number of baryons now there are. Okay, so from here, you calculate number of baryons. And what you conclude that this is precisely all training variants. So actually, you know, every baryon is basically contained in stars. Every baryon is in the shining matter. So the dark matter, which is 10 times more than normal matter, actually cannot be baryon because this would be screwed up. So the logic here is BBN fixes what eta has to be. It fixes it to be 10 to minus 9 times something, but precise number. After BBN, there is no way you could change this number. So it must be whatever is observed now. But you know what n gamma is now, so you can tell what n of what the baryons are now. And then you can compare this observation, how many baryons I see in the stars. And then you'll see, and the comparison is, yeah, I see all the baryons and they are hidden in the stars.
Isn't most of the mass in clusters of galaxies gas instead of stars?
But it's also shining, so yeah.
Yeah, it's...
Yeah. Typically, you know, the plasma is quite heated, and yeah, so it's... And you can see it. Yeah. Other questions? Okay, I'll tell you the second argument tomorrow.